We now continue our string of extensive interviews with candidates for Washington's governor. And today we're going to hear from one of the Democratic candidates, State Senator representing the 5th Legislative District, Mark Mullett. Senator Mullett is facing off against a fellow Democrat, Bob Ferguson. And it was Ferguson who got the official endorsement from Governor Inslee. But Mullett says that high-level endorsements are not important to him.
You know, it goes back, like Governor Inslee, like I opposed the long-term care payroll tax during the 2019 session. So I have the unique privilege of, you know, my own governor came out to try to take me out of my Senate seat back in 2020. That's the only time in our state's history an incumbent governor's gone after a member of his own party. I've never been a rubber stamp for what I feel are unnecessary tax increases. So I've stood up to Governor Inslee before, and I think right now I look forward to talking to voters, because I talk to voters now and they're really glad that there was a Democrat willing to stand up saying, hey, I don't think this long-term care payroll tax is a good idea. And so I've always been on the right side of, I think, where average families are in our state, even if that doesn't line up with the extremes of either party.
So it sounds like you think the Democrats have tacked a little too far to the left. Is that what I'm hearing here?
That is 100% accurate. So And I think that's been where, I don't think it takes much political courage to attack the other party, but I think it takes political courage is to say and admit when your own party's not getting something right. And that's really been my focus in this campaign.
Okay, so where else do you disagree with your fellow Democrats?
So our Supreme Court legalized drug possession in 2021 through a decision called Blake. And this Blake decision, like, I'm in the Senate and I'm like, this is not happening on my watch. We are not legalizing fentanyl while I'm in the Senate. The person I was fighting was our Attorney General, Bob Ferguson. He was urging the legislature to follow the path of Oregon and decriminalize drugs. I had a very vocal disagreement with our Attorney General on this issue. You know, even though it's part of the Washington State Democratic Party platform that we should have done the Oregon model, I'm like, that's not where the average family in our state is that. Nobody thinks that we should be legalizing possession of fentanyl on Third Avenue in Seattle. And I won that fight. I was the Democratic senator who stood up and said, we can do better than Oregon and we're not going to follow their path. And we made sure there is accountability for people using fentanyl, meth and heroin on Third Avenue in Seattle. And if it hadn't been for my leadership, if we had gone the way of A.G. Ferguson, all those things would be legal right now.
Has there been any follow-up, though, on appropriating the money for the kind of treatment facilities necessary to create a permanent change?
I think this is, to me, the whole advantage of having a small business owner instead of a lawyer in the governor's office is the common thread of small business owners is we all hate wasting money. And that is what we need in the executive branch right now. We need a governor who hates wasting money. And right now, we're not getting maximum bang for our buck out of our tax dollars. Every governor for the last three decades has been a lawyer. It's time to have a small business mentality in the governor's office to make sure we're not asking for more tax dollars. Instead, we're actually getting results from the billions of dollars we currently spend.
We're hearing from candidate for Governor Mark Mullett, who is a state senator, also owns Zeke's Pizza and Ben and Jerry's ice cream franchises in the Issaquah area. And he feels that the Democratic Party, he's a Democrat, has gotten a reputation for being anti-business. But he wanted to emphasize that he is different from the rest of the party.
My primary role in the Senate is I chair our state construction budget. And I feel really strongly that our permit system in this state is not working as it should. It should be quick. It should be predictable. And when I go to open a restaurant location, there's nothing more frustrating than encountering unnecessary permit delays. And I've had a front row seat as the chair of this construction budget now for a decade, knowing that we can do better. And I think this is what I hope to change is I want to make it easier to build the things we need to build in our state. We need to build housing. We need to build roads. We need to build office space. We need to build commercial space. And right now we're driving up the cost of building those things. And that's what's making our state unaffordable to the point where I'm worried my own kids, when they finish school, like my oldest daughter is a junior up at Western, when Isabel finishes school next year, I don't know how she's going to afford to live here. We've made it so expensive to build.
You can look up some of the estimated times for getting construction permits here in King County, for example, and it's pretty long. And actually, I did a commentary complaining about that and got some pushback from the people who who regulate these projects saying, hey, you know, these regulations are here for a reason. We don't want the we don't want a mudslide to take out your house. We don't want the building to collapse in a heavy rainstorm, things like that. But you're saying that there are things that are just what? Busy work and unnecessary?
I look at it what I call consolidated permit review. So turn in a permit, and instead of having one department give their feedback and you give it back to the applicant, and then they fix that one issue, they come back in 2 weeks later and all of a sudden a different department said, hey, go fix this issue. Like, what we can do better on it is putting everything up front in one piece of feedback, right? And say, hey, here's the four things you need to fix. You fix those four things, your permit's going to be approved. It'll be approved quickly. And I think the state can be a financial partner to make this happen. Like, I understand cities and counties are short on money. Our operating budget, when I first got elected, this was in 2013, was $34 billion. And the budget we passed this March was north of $71 billion. So in a very short amount of time, our state revenue growth has gone from $34 billion to $71 billion. We have revenue growth that we can share with cities and counties that are willing to speed up permit time.
So you think it's possible to actually, so what would you say would be a reasonable time from, let's say, architectural drawings to completed project?
You should be able to get your permit done in 60 to 120 days. I mean, this is not an impossible goal by any stretch of the imagination.
Seriously? You think it's possible?
You could deliver on that? Standards and have clear, predictable standards, and other states are doing this. And so we've seen other states doing this, and I want to be the first blue state in the country that acknowledges we can do a better job of making it easier to build stuff.
State Senator Mark Mullett running for governor. More of our conversation at 8:15. He'll talk about the carbon tax to lower gas prices, capital gains tax, using it to cut property taxes, what to do about protesters and drug addicts. And all these interviews are on the Ross Files podcast at mynorthwest.com, the complete uncut interviews. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Joining us for today's edition of Crime and Punishment is Casey McNerfney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Let's talk about family members. And in particular, your office has a family support division whose job is to do what?
So their job is to do a number of things, like establishing child support and establishing parentage and enforcing child support obligations, and then also connecting parents with community resources. You know, a lot of people think of the prosecutor's office just for the criminal matters that we handle because those are the most commonly reported, but there's also other divisions like the civil division and this division, the family support division.
Years ago, when I was covering the court, I would sit in on some of these family hearings, and they are gut-wrenching. When you see just how deep the animus can be between a mother and a father with the child sitting right there, and their entire future is in the balance. And you're right, these are emotional cases. So what types of matters do you find yourself handling here?
So a lot of it is child support obligations and addressing those. Here's a good clip from Kathleen O'Brien, who's the chief of that division, explaining the work that her division does.
The family support division does not represent either parent in a case that's filed by our office. Our office represents the division of child support and all the cases that our office initiates on behalf of our client. The division of child support are referred to us. So depending on the type of case that we file, the role of our office in the case might be very limited. That being said, a parent in the case can represent himself or herself on their own issues in the case. One example of this might be back child support due and owing to a custodial parent. So the parent to whom the back support is owed in the case would be arguing for this kind of relief from the court himself or herself. So this is just one example of an issue that a parent could bring on their own in one of our state-initiated cases.
And so one easy way to think about this is most people know about child support, but when that isn't paid, who goes to court to enforce that? And that's one of the roles that the family support division takes on. And so also some folks might be listening to this and saying, okay, what's in it for me? You know, how can I benefit from this? You know, or someone who I know. And that's one of the things that I asked Kathleen, and she had a really good answer for that. Here's what she had to say.
A lot of people have a mis- misnomer or misconception that in order to avail themselves of our services, Casey, that they have to have some connection to a program, be it TANF, a public assistance program, or food stamps, or state medical insurance. And none of that is true. You can be fully employed and living on the East Side and making a handsome income and be eligible for our free legal services. And I think that people, unfortunately, they don't know this, and they spend money to hire private counsel, or they try to do it themselves to modify a child support order post-divorce when their financial circumstances have changed, and they spend money on an attorney, or they, you know, they try to do this themselves. And these are things that our office might be able to assist them with, including the filing fees and all the headaches that go with, you know, initiating an action. And that's really what we've tried to get out to the general public, is that we are here for everyone, not just the people that are recipients of benefits, federal or state benefits. And we really want people to know this. We want people to call us and say, is this a case that you might be able to take or to work? And we can help them figure that out. So we really want people to get child support orders that reflect their ability to pay, and that people can pay consistently to support their children.
That's a good point. These disputes happen to families at all income levels. And so she's saying you don't necessarily have to have an attorney to pursue one of these cases.
Right. Yeah. If you need a modification in a child support arrangement, you know, a great example of that is early on in a child's life, that might be daycare. Later on, that might be school tuition. You know, it changes over the years. And so if you need a modification there, you don't have to get an attorney. And a lot of people don't know that. And so they do. And they don't realize that their tax dollars actually pay for the work that the family support division does, and they can get those services without having to pay tens of thousands of dollars in some cases. And what also happens is we sometimes see people realize this after they've already paid those bills. And so if folks are hearing this and think, well, how do I benefit from this? Really, the easiest way to do it is just to Google King County Family Support Division. The top results will give you the contact info for the Seattle office or the Kent office. And I think it really will save people a lot of money and hopefully some stress too.
And you just call and you go in for an appointment then, and they lay out the case?
Yeah, they can walk through, and most of the hearings are on Zoom too. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but there are some good accommodations, and they can walk through what services they do have, what they can do for each individual case.
Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Thanks, Casey.
Great to see you, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. A possible new treatment for heart pain. Let's page our practicing cardiac surgeon.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. This has to do with angina or angina, which is heart pain. So what have they discovered here?
Yeah, Dave. This is an interesting topic. Obviously, I'm biased towards it because of my medical specialty. But angina, is also known as angina pectoris, is chest pain. And it's chest pain from the heart muscle itself because it's getting an inadequate amount of oxygen. There's an imbalance between the amount of oxygen being delivered by the blood cells to the heart muscle and the demand of the heart muscle itself for oxygen. So there's a mismatch. And when this happens, the body responds, or the heart responds, by causing pain. It's common in people with coronary artery disease, and about almost 10 million Americans are estimated to have angina every year, with about 500,000 new cases occurring every year. So it's really, really common. The treatment for it initially is medical. You'll go to your doctor, and your doctor will put you on medication. But if you're unable to get relief of your angina, you may be referred to a cardiac surgeon for coronary bypass. They bypass the blocked or narrowed arteries on the surface of the heart to deliver more blood and hence more oxygen to the heart muscle. But the blood then gets into the muscle itself through little tiny microvessels. And there's no treatment for getting the blood from the big vessels into the muscle itself through the little vessels if medications don't work. And so when that happens, you have a condition that's called refractory angina, or angina that doesn't really respond to treatment. And those patients, although it's not necessarily life-threatening, can have a severe impact on their quality of life. So there's been a lot of research looking for new therapies.
Right. And I understand this past week, there was a research group that actually seemed to come up with something.
There was a study that was presented looking at a potential gene therapy.
All right. So this is not a surgical procedure then. This is somehow you can implant a gene that, what, widens these blood vessels?
Actually, what the gene is it's a gene that delivers three different types of something called vascular endothelial growth factor, or VEGF.
Vascular endothelial growth factor.
And VEGF is known to stimulate the growth of new blood vessels, microvessels, actually. And the way this is being delivered is by attaching this gene into a virus, an adenovirus, a harmless virus, where it can basically, you go through the chest and you inject it into the muscle of the heart itself. And hopefully it stimulates the growth of these new microvessels. And so it's a form of gene therapy where you're basically introducing a gene, and the gene causes the growth of new blood vessels and can hopefully reduce the severity of angina in patients who are otherwise refractory to treatment.
Okay, meaning that the routine bypass surgery didn't work. So what were the study results? How effective was this on the test cases?
So the thing is they did a study. They did it on 32 patients. And in those 32 patients, after 12 months of treatment, their patients had an increase in their total exercise duration from an average of 359 seconds to 477 seconds. So that's a pretty significant increase. And then the frequency of angina decreased by almost half in terms of the number of episodes that people were experiencing. But it shows that by using this gene therapy, they could take the patients who have the worst forms of angina pectoris, who don't respond to medication, who don't respond to surgery, and by using this new therapy and injecting these genes into the heart muscle, they could grow new microvessels that would relieve their symptoms and improve their overall quality of life.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's get a check on the economy with CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. This morning, she's talking about the peak boomer generation and the challenges they face in trying to save for retirement.
Peak boomers are defined as the Americans who are turning 65 between now and the year 2030. Dave, there are 30 million peak boomers.
Yeah.
30. That is crazy.
You know.
And look, maybe of your fancy, smart, very knowledgeable and hardworking folks that are around you in your group, maybe everyone's fine. But when we look at the vast majority of Americans, we find something really interesting. That is that many of these people think they're doing better than they are. And then they get to retirement and they have many fewer options because they've sort of underestimated what their needs would be. And you know what? It's a different question to say, how do you feel about retirement, rather than have you actually run your retirement numbers?
Yeah.
Because those can lead you to very different conclusions.
Yeah. So who is qualified to run the retirement? There are a lot of online calculators you can use. Do you trust those?
Absolutely. And I think that anyone who goes to a retirement website, so like if your company has a 401k or a 403b, there are always calculators around. And you can go to a myriad different calculators out there at any big investment house, okay? And you can run it. The problem is most people aren't running it. And when they do run it, they're running it too late to actually impact their retirement scenarios.
Yeah.
So what happens is that we are finding a lot of people are getting to retirement, especially in this era, not factoring in that inflation could have ever gone up because it was low for so long. And there's a big shock. And what we also know is that too many Americans are thinking that Social Security will be the main source of their retirement income. And, you know, listen, Social Security in general was only intended to replace about 40% of your pre-retirement income. So if you were relying on that to do more, you're going to have to spend a lot less in retirement, or you're going to have to go back to work.
Yeah. Can you give us a reality check on just exactly how much Social Security is for the average person?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about, let's call it between, it's like $1,600 basically for the average worker, right?
A month.
But the biggest problem here is that when you look at Social Security, there are many choices for how you can claim your benefits. So a lot of people seem to think, it's very interesting, like I guess until you get focused on retirement, that you don't really know what the system is about. The real issue here is that when you look at Social Security, there are three big ages to consider. There's age 62, there's age 67, and there is age 70. Now, 67, that middle one, that is called your full retirement age for anyone born after 1960. And if that is, if you're targeting age 67, you're going to have what's called your full retirement benefit. So, you know, again, if it's $1,600, you'll get it. That's fine. But let's presume that you say, well, wait, I need the money sooner. Okay. If you need the money sooner, you can claim as early as age 62. The problem is when you do that, your benefits will be permanently reduced.
Yeah.
So maybe instead of getting this $1,800 check, right, maybe you're going to get a $1,400 or $1,500 check. That actually adds up every single month over time to a ton of money. And if you have a spouse who's relying on your Social Security, because if you're a non-working person, you can get half of your spouse's Social Security check. But if I've chosen a lower amount, it's not just for me, it's for my non-working spouse for the rest of that person's life. It's a bad deal. And if you can wait till age 70, that's the best deal going. It's really, it is amazing. It's sort of the quiet, amazing choice here. If you can wait to claim to your age 70, you're going to raise your monthly lifetime benefits. And it goes up by 8% a year for every year you wait.
We're hearing from CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. And so the question I had for her was, okay, if it turns out that you guessed wrong on Social Security and you don't have enough money to get by, what do you do?
A lot of them are going back into the workforce. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's interesting because I interviewed a labor economist about that. Her name is Teresa Ghilarducci. And she said that when she digs through the data, she finds that basically only about 1 in 5 Americans who are like 62 to 70 have enough money to maintain their standard of living in retirement. That doesn't seem like a lot, 1 in 5. So what is happening is for a lot of these others, they are retired, but they're spending much less money than they thought they would be able to spend.
Yeah.
And about, let's say, 28%, a bunch of others, they're working. They just can't afford to retire. So they're either working part-time or they're working full-time. And that's a lot of people working in their 60s, a lot.
Yeah. So this actually is something that people who are in like their 20s should be listening to. Start early, basically.
Yeah. I mean, look, the thing that's kind of fascinating to me is like, I know in your 20s, it seems impossible, right? It really does. But if you ask every single person who's in their 50s and 60s, you say, well, what allows you to actually gather up these savings? And they always say, start early, start early, start early. So maybe the 20s, you know, you just try to put in up to your matching component. And maybe in your 30s, you're going from like 5 or 6%, maybe it's 10% and 15%, and you work your way up. It's hard if you wait too long because then you cannot actually impact your retirement savings. But if you are counting, you know, I always run into people and they say, oh, I'm just going to work forever. Well, what if your boss doesn't want you? I mean, I'm in media. I mean, at the end of my 3-year contract, the new person who comes in might be like, you're nice. See ya.
Yeah. Well, that's not comforting at all. So,
sorry, dude.
You 20-somethings, no matter what it takes, save something for when you're no longer a 20-something.
Please.
Yeah.
Or even 30-something. Just do it. Just do it.
CBS's Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A little boy in Louisiana practices some kindness and gets a whole lot in return. Here's our favorite, CBS's Steve Hartman.
Inside Buckfather, an outdoor sporting store in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, we met a great American success story.
Because it's about you.
At 42, owner Matt Busbus and his partners have built and sold several outdoor companies worth hundreds of millions. But Matt says he's never felt richer than he did the day he got the dollar.
I haven't had that much faith in humanity in a very long time.
He says it all began about a month ago.
It was early morning, and the fire alarm was going off inside his condo complex. So Matt shot out of bed and raced down the stairs, only to discover there was no fire. But he's awake now. So even though he was wearing mismatched clothes and all disheveled, Matt decided to go out for a cup of coffee.
And as he was about to enter the shop, he remembered he hadn't done his morning prayer. So, as the security camera shows, Matt stepped to the corner of the patio.
And I start to slowly open my eyes, and there's a kid coming at me about my height.
And with his fist clenched. So Matt prepared for battle.
And he goes, and reveals a dollar bill. And I go, what?
If your homies, here's a dollar.
This is 9-year-old Kelvin Ellis Jr.
I always wanted to help a homeless person, and I finally had the opportunity.
Kelvin says he had just gotten the dollar for good grades. It was the only money he had to his name. Matt was so touched. He invited Kelvin in for a snack, connected with the boy's father, who was next door, and promised to stay in touch.
What's up, dude?
As a reward for his kindness, Matt gave Kelvin a shopping spree. 40 seconds to pick out whatever he wanted in the store, including a new bike. Kelvin says it was great, but definitely not what he wanted to get for his dollar.
What were you hoping would come from that?
Joy.
Joy?
Because I helped someone. Give some away, you feel like you got a lot of things from it.
If you give, you're actually going to get more out of that. I couldn't grasp that as a kid. And if we can spread that around, everything changes.
A dollar. So well spent.
Cheers to friends forever.
Let's return now to our conversation with Washington State Senator Mark Mullett, who is running for governor, and he's running as a Democrat, but he makes it clear that even though he has the Democrat Party label, he does not align with the party on everything, especially how the state taxes people.
I first say there's three initiatives right now. I'm voting exactly how I voted in the legislature. I voted against the long-term care payroll tax. We already talked about that. I voted against the capital gains tax in 2021 because we had an $8 billion budget surplus. And I said, this is the best time we've ever had to lower a tax. I don't know if that was lowering property taxes or removing the sales tax on clothing. But I said, if we're going to pass capital gains, we have to lower something else. Well, that didn't happen. And so I didn't end up supporting the capital gains tax. I supported the Climate Commitment Act. And this is where I think there's going to be a huge difference between Governor Inslee and myself. Like, we were supposed to get roughly $500 million a year of revenue from those climate auctions that we could use to fight climate change. When Inslee started the program last year, rather than banning speculators from these climate auctions, he invited the speculators in. And the only thing you get by inviting the speculators in is higher auction prices, which I think in Inslee's mind was a huge win because we generated $2 billion of tax revenue in the first year in 2023. But that is the decision the governor can change. And that's what I would change. I would not allow speculators in this early stage of the climate commitment auctions. And I would cap the auction price to make sure we're generating the amount of revenue that's closer to what we did when we passed the bill. Because you can fight climate change with $500 million a year. You don't need $2 billion a year and price out average working families from living in Washington state. And so that you don't have that flexibility with long-term care or capital gains. Like, that's why I'm supporting those initiatives. The Climate Commitment Act initiative, like, I'm not supporting that initiative because as governor, I will have flexibility to lower gas prices, and I will exercise that flexibility to do exactly that. We'll fight climate change and have lower gas prices, and we can do both. Right now, I think our current governor is giving us a false choice.
Okay, so to be clear, you're saying you could keep this carbon fee program in effect, but by cutting out the speculators, it would not have an effect on the price of gasoline.
Well, it'll have an effect, but that effect will be more around, you know, 10 or 12 cents a gallon, not the 52 cents a gallon we saw last summer.
Okay.
And so I think you have to be intellectually honest with yourselves. Like, it's going to have some increase in the price of gas. It's hard to predict exactly what that is, but it'll be, you know, the increase in the gas price from the climate auctions is just tracked exactly where the auction prices go off. The higher the auction price, the higher the gas price. The lower the auction price, the lower the gas price increase. And so that's my goal as governor, is I will minimize those gas price increases as much as possible.
You don't think it was price gouging?
I don't. I know Inslee was trying to blame the oil companies. I don't know where he came up with that idea, because to me, if you were anyone being intellectually honest with themselves, knew that the price of these carbon auctions was going to drive up the price of gas. Anyone who thought like, oh, these companies are all just going to eat this and take a loss for the year, that's not how it works when you're selling an inelastic product that people have to buy. And that's that gasoline is the definition of an inelastic product that people have to buy. You can't get to it from work without it, unless, of course, you have an electric car, which I do, which is nice. But my kids don't. And yeah. So it impacts people all across the economic spectrum.
Okay. Capital gains tax. So you are against that. Would you try to get rid of it?
Yeah, I voted against it in 21, and I'm only going to support a capital gains tax if we put constitutionally protected put lowering of another tax, mm-hmm. because I'm tired of saying we're making our tax system more progressive by just creating new taxes. Like, if you want to make the system more progressive, you raise one tax and you lower another tax. Mm-hmm. And once we have a proposal that says, hey, we're going to use the capital gains revenue so everyone gets a rebate on their property tax bill, yeah, let's have that discussion. To me, that's a worthwhile public policy discussion. But creating new taxes when we've had this kind of budget surplus and budget growth just for the sake of creating them, to me, is not what the average working family in our state wants to see right now.
We're hearing from state senator and candidate for governor Mark Mullett. To the campus protests, the blocking of roads and the confrontations, what are his thoughts on the line between free speech and public order?
You got to be able to remove people who are blocking the freeway. I mean, to me, this is much more of a black and white issue, and those areas have to be free and clear. We're obviously seeing the same challenge right now on college campuses, and I have been supportive of removing people that are making it difficult to navigate college campuses currently as well. And so I don't want to see a repeat of CHOP and CHAZ. I think that was pure insanity, what we saw in the summer of 2020 in Seattle. And that's where I think, once again, I'm different as a Democrat, because I will speak up and say, hey, I think it is important that those public spaces need to be open to the public and they need to be safe.
And what's the line for you? Is it encampments? Is it encampments that block access? Does there have to be a violent element before crowds are dispersed? What happens if people suddenly create sleeping dragons and try to create gridlock downtown? What's the line for you?
I think the public spaces need to be free and clear. And it's that simple. And that space could be a freeway on ramp. It could be a public park. You can't allow the encampments. I mean, we say it's compassionate, but what I see is we're just allowing people to basically overdose on the streets of Seattle. And to me, that's not compassionate. And so I think those people should be removed in all circumstances. And the public right of way should be clear and safe for people so they can go to and from school. They can go to and from work. And people should feel safe in their local community as they walk around.
On the issue of removing people who, as you point out, are using fentanyl in public, I know you're against that, but I think the issue still is, are there treatment facilities available, or do you just jail people like we used to do?
So I look at we have $480 million a year of cannabis tax revenue. You heard that right, $480 million a year. When we passed that initiative back in 2012, the idea was we're going to use that to focus on substance abuse treatment, public safety at the local level. These are all good things. We'd use that tax dollars. We're not doing that. And I feel our missing link is secure substance abuse treatment. Secure, meaning we're an outlier in the state of our substance treatment facilities. The front door is always open. So you go through withdrawal, you can walk out and leave. If you're using drugs in public, I don't want to put you in jail for a year, but I do want to put you in a treatment facility where the front door is locked. And I don't know if you're going to be in there for 30 days or 45 days or 60 days. I'm not sure, but I want to give you the best chance humanly possible to beat your addiction. And to me, you can't beat your addiction if the front door of your treatment facility is unlocked. And to me, this is the missing link of what we have right now. But I firmly believe if everyone using drugs in public on Third Avenue in Seattle right now was put into a treatment facility and you walk down Third Avenue 12 months later, I think it would look fundamentally different.
State Senator Mark Mullett, candidate for governor. He'll be on the Ross Files page at MyNorthWest.com, part of our growing library of extensive interviews. You'll really know these guys once you listen to these podcasts. So far we've talked with Semi Bird, Dave Reichert, and now Mark Mullett. So go to the Ross Files page at MyNorthWest.com to hear the whole thing. You're wondering, where is Bob Ferguson? He's the sort of the heir apparent to Jay Inslee. We've asked, and we're waiting. 8:49, Seattle's Morning News. Over the weekend, the roast of Tom Brady on Netflix. Here was comedian Nikki Glaser on Tom Brady's rings.
Five-time Super Bowl MVP, most career wins, most career touchdowns. You have seven rings. Well, eight now that Giselle gave hers back, but...
And G. Scott loved it. In fact, you think that this shows just what humanity is capable of.
It's what America needs right now.
A sense of humor?
This last night felt like All in the Family, right? Back in the day with Archie Bunker. And they were just saying things that was, oh, can't believe you said that. But you know what? Sometimes you got to say it. It's needed. We all need a good laugh. To my next point is this. I want you right now to think of your most favorite comedy movie era ever. I guarantee you that that movie is from 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. Because what happens is someone writes a movie, and they write the movie, and bam, here it is. Here's that screenplay. And then it needs to go through four or five committees before it is actually put out there and made a movie. Meaning, oh, you can't say that. Oh, you're going to offend this person. Oh, you're going to offend that person. Oh, that's good. That can't be said. Colleen, Dave, last night, I was sitting there laughing my tail off. It was funny. And what was so funny about it? It was like, we need this. We actually need some of the jokes that you actually, in air quotes, can't say anymore. And man, it was done. One of the things that Tom Brady said, he says, you know, people always ask me all the time, which ring of mine was my favorite? And I always say, my next ring, right? He says, actually, I take that back. Now, the best ring ever is the ring camera that had Bill Belichick leaving a woman's house at 6 a.m.
Oh, my.
No holds barred.
You know, and right now on, you know, I'll tell you what's going on X, by the way. That's my favorite place to be at is on X. But right now, Aaron Fernandez, his fiance, is mad at the Tom Brady roast because her, you know, fiance, ex-fiance, I don't know what you want to call him now that he's gone, but Aaron Hernandez, of course, is not living anymore. And so she's upset. And one of the things she says is what a sad, cruel world we live in to allow that. Was it sad and cruel when your fiance took the lives of others? You know what I mean? But anyway, my point is like, see, that's what I'm talking about. They're trying to make this PC. And sometimes comedy just needs a place where we can go to and hear things that nobody else would say, but they did. But I know somebody's listening right now saying, but gee, I don't care. Let me just laugh. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you laugh.
So who has the authority to say, sorry, that went too far?
Nobody. None of us. Like sometimes, all I'm saying is last night I was just reminded how things aren't funny anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And how we watch comedy movies and we're like, it's not funny. And so we find ourselves rewatching Tommy Boy, or we rewatching National Lampoon's Vacation, or we watch, whatever the case might be, we find ourselves watching comedies from the 80s and 90s, Colleen.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's happening is, I just saw on Netflix Jerry Seinfeld's Unfrosted.
It was so good.
It was, well, it depends on, I was listening to a lot of reviews too. Some people thought it was good because it was just outright silly. But what he was doing was, he was looking for a way to say some of the jokes you can't say by setting it back in the 60s and making it about a completely ridiculous thing. Yes. And then bringing in all these memes from January 6th and other stuff.
Oh, there was so much
that
there.
You couldn't make fun of if you were actually making fun of the real thing.
You want to know what makes something funny? Is when there's a little bit of truth to it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, that's what makes things funny. And I just think that, man, I can't believe I'm sounding this way today. I mean, and I just think that a lot of things aren't funny anymore because they're just so filtered and watered down. And last night, Colleen, I had a moment. And by the way, Nikki Glaser.
Tom Brady went after Kim Kardashian. I thought that was pretty funny.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. The whole Kim Kardashian thing. Last night, I found myself, because she was booed, they said some raunchy stuff about Kim Kardashian on there. And then I thought, you know what? Kim Kardashian always takes these jokes on the chin. She never says anything negative about anyone. I found myself saying, I think I'm a Kim Kardashian fan.
Yeah. She shows up.
She knew what she was getting into. She was front and center, took those jokes on the chin, and is still laughing. And Tom Brady said, hey, thank you for being here. I know you've had it rough. The only concern I have for you is that you're here and that your kids are at home with their dad. Oh my goodness, that's funny.
It was funny.
But Nikki Glaser, if you guys get a chance, she was on fire. Sully, you love it, man.
Make America laugh again.
I've seen many of her comedy specials. She's ridiculously funny.
Funny. Like
really funny.
Raunchy, funny.
That's why I'll probably go home this afternoon and watch with Eddie Murphy.
Come on,
back
man.
In the day. Because I want half, Eddie. I mean, the good old stuff. Are you kidding me? That's why I love Montana so much. People aren't filtered over
Jim
there.
Ursula, that's 10 why Zebra went to Montana.
Yeah.
Thank you, G.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.